Good afternoon. It is Thursday, February the 1st, 2018. 15 minutes after the hour, you're tuned into the Now program. I'm Scott Spears, your host, and we have got a great program today. A matter of fact, just pull the knob, the button, whatever you have off of your radio or listening device, and stay with this program today because we have got two great guests over the next 2 hours. Coming up next hour will be legendary gossip columnist. I'm sure you remember her from Good Morning America and The Tomorrow Show with Tom Snyder and all the work she did on the entertainment news programs in the 80s and 90s and even into the 2000s. We'll be joined by Rona Barrett next hour here on the Now program. Now, this hour, we're joined by a gentleman who has had quite an amazing career, from working at Disneyland to being a magician to having a career that has spanned more than a half century. He was Rebo the Clown on the magical land of Alakazam. It's a pleasure to bring to these microphones Bev Bergeron. Bev, how are you?
Okay. Wondering what in the world you're calling me for. So we're sitting here in beautiful sunny Florida, Orlando, Florida. Oh, I heard your news. It said something like 12 degrees there. I'm happy I'm not there.
During your career, did you spend much time in the Midwest?
Oh, yes. I was all over that in the mid-50s, all over that area. I was in Ohio. Something I did that's near you, which you may not even think about, I helped start Hickory Farms of Ohio out of Sylvania. Sylvania. Right next to Toledo.
Tell us what part you played in that.
I was going around selling the magic sets of Mark Wilson at that time. This is 57, and I found myself talking to those people in Kansas City that had the product, didn't know what they were doing with it. Armor really made it, and so I said, gee, I got a degree in marketing and advertising and everything else, so maybe I should put it to use. And I went and talked to them up in Toledo, and before I knew it, I was made like a vice president, if you'd call it that, and I took off to the West Coast and opened up that whole area there, and made them. I mean, we were making hundreds of thousands of dollars at that time. I was doing very, very well. And then Mark Wilson got hold of the sponsors for Scotch Brand Cellophane Tape, our first show, which was syndicated. That's 59. And so I got off the road and went into Dallas and set up Mark Wilson's shows, wrote most of them. And then he said, we got to have a clown. He says, I sold a client a clown, and we're broke. We're out of money. And we will be sued. And I should have said, what do you mean, we? Because anyway, I created Rebo the Clown. And from there, he took those 13 tapes. We were the first show ever videotaped and nationally syndicated at that time. And the Scotch Brand Cellophane Tape, of course, sponsored it. They controlled the making of the tapes, and they were controlling the machines at that time. So any studio that bought one of their machines got our show. And Mark took that tape around and showed it to other sponsors across the country. Finally got Kellogg's. And then it was just a case of setting it up with CBS, a time period. We finally got it in 1960. We opened in Hollywood in 1st of October. Gosh, that was 1960. That's a long time ago. We pioneered a lot of stuff. I mean, even techniques with the camera, which was then, you know, just black and white. And the editing was, my Lord, They have to do it with Scotch brand cellophane tape, cut it at a diagonal angle. And we had to go to black, which I noticed that nobody goes to anymore. The reason why you went to black was because of the editing. Nowadays, gosh, they just go from one commercial to another. In fact, I get mixed up as to what car manufacturer is being advertised. They run one car commercial right after another, right into each other, with no going to black or anything. Back in my day, my Lord, if you ran two car commercials in a row, you were sinful. Things have changed.
Things certainly have. Bev, the character of Rebo the Clown, when you had to create this, where did the name come from, and how did you see this character?
I did not like the clown that was really dominating television at that time, Claribel. And there was a whole bunch of different Claribels, started by Captain Kangaroo, and then he quit it and became his own character. But Claribel was a mischievous clown. I didn't want Rebo to be mischievous. He was like a 3 or 4 year old kid that would run out in the road chasing a ball and get hit by a car, but he wouldn't get hurt. He'd jump up smiling and laughing and happy. That's the way I played him, and I had to convince Mark Wilson that was it. One time we were doing a trick where we needed a broken plate, and Mark said, "Now, Rebo, at this point, you'll take the plate and break it, then we'll pick up the pieces and I'll put them back together." And I said, "No, I can't do that." He says, "Yes, you got to do it. We got to have a broken plate." I said, "Well, I'll pretend to juggle it, or I'll knock it off a table or something. It'll be accidental, but Rebo will not break the plate on purpose. And if I did, you should correct me and say, 'Rebo, you shouldn't do that. That's wrong.'" And it took me a while to train Mark to start thinking that way. But that's the way I fought to keep it. The kids really related to Rebo. In fact, that was a bit of a problem there at the beginning. Mark would name was mentioned at the beginning of the show, "Mark Wilson." And then all during the show, Mark is turning to me, say, "Rebo, move the box over here. Rebo, turn the box around. Rebo, open the box. Rebo, hand me that. Rebo." So what name do you think was getting to the kids?
Yeah.
Rebo.
Rebo, absolutely. Where did the name come from?
That's a good question. I wanted Bevo, B-E-V, Bev, like my first name, Bev, and then adding the O. And Mark, of course, didn't like it because it was the name of a near beer during the Prohibition days. In the Music Man musical, you know, You Got Troubles, the name is, you're trying out Cupid, trying out Tailor-Made Cigarettes, trying out Bevo. Well, that was a near beer, name of a near beer. It was also the name of the University of Texas mascot, which I'm a graduate from, good old Texas, who lost all the football games this year. and I can understand Mark's feelings on that. So actually an artist kind of wrote the R-E-B-O on it. We were using the roll down of credits back in 1959. The credits didn't come down electronically. You may remember, I don't think you remember, but you may have read about it. We used a big drum, which they'd turn in front of a camera, and the stuff would roll on through. And the edge of the drum, if you can visualize this, a big round thing with, you could stick the name. He put the name Rebo on there and said, "If you want to change it at showtime, we can change it. Let me know before we tape it." And that was the way it got. It was more or less just stuck on there. So Mark stopped calling me Bevo and started calling me Rebo.
That's interesting. You know, Bev, 10 minutes into this interview, obviously the land of Alakazam, the magical land of Alakazam, was a big part of your career and a highly watched show, network television, when there was only three channels. And the name in front of that was Mark Wilson. But it kind of sounds so far, and correct me if I'm wrong, like possibly you and Mark did not have the best relationship.
Oh, we had a strange relationship. We still talk, and I'd say that we're closer now than we were then, because I had a more theatrical background than he did, and he was sort of set with his magic ways, sort of a bit old-fashioned, and I was trying to change things and get a modern look, a modern feeling to everything. And I had a partner with me on that. One of the writers was Bobby Tarchi Towner, who graduated from the Lee Strasberg's class in New York at the same time with Marilyn Monroe and all that group in about 1954. And Bobby and I just wanted to make major changes, which we did. We got a lot of it in. Thank God for that. And that's what made our show then really jump. We about the 18th show we did, we started doing little vignettes and storytelling using magic, and it just made a total difference. It put us number one on the kids' shows on Saturday morning. And at one time, like you commented, there was only three networks then, and they weren't completely all over the country. But in Las Vegas, we pulled a 19 rating, which is, look at the ratings that these number one shows on television today are drawing, only sixes and sevens. And we had a consistent 9 and 10. So we were doing pretty good.
And not bad at all. For people who don't remember the program, what was the premise? What would people see if they watched a typical episode of The Magical Land of Alakazam?
Well, we'd open with a standard just magic trick, like you'd see a magician perform. And then we'd go usually into some sort of a story. That was what we finally got into a good format on. And I don't know how to explain it. Some of these things were taken from old nursery rhymes, and other ones would have Evillo, the villain magician, would put Nani or Rebo or both of us in peril at the same time, like an old-fashioned I've come for the rent type thing. And we had where Rebo was going to be the world's greatest magician, or Rebo had a magic shop, and Mark would come in and see what he was doing and how he was doing it, and fix things up because I'd always be the one to screw things up. And Nani was always put in peril. She'd get stuck in a box or something. And by the way, we weren't allowed to saw a woman in half. CBS wouldn't let us do that, and or put swords into a box with her. So we put magic wands into a box, and we split Nani apart by using a little train. That was an idea of mine, and that became a very popular trick at the state fairs that we worked, and it ended up a much better design every year we went out. We had guys that have really great ideas on what design would change it. It turned out really a nice trick. It just people loved it. But I don't know. It just became a fun show. Mark would also do a puzzle trick type thing. As to here's a pencil that will write any color you want. Just name it. And of course he'd write, if they'd say red, he'd write R-E-D, and that everybody would laugh and applaud. And we had about up to 400 children in the audience consistently, so that was fun. My mother came in one time from Texas and wanted to know, how in the world do you control all these children? I said, oh, it's easy. We don't allow mothers or grandmothers to sit with them.
The show at one point went from CBS to ABC. Why did that happen?
Right.
Why did that happen?
Kellogg's dropped us. And I don't know why to this day, because it was a cheap show for them, and it was, had high ratings, doing wonders for them. We did commercial for them too, and also a box top, not box top, back of cereal box. you know, the tricks and puzzles and things. But they dropped us, and the thing is, ABC picked us up. We didn't lose 1 week. They wanted us, and we went over to ABC, but the show wasn't as good at ABC. We use a lot of rerun stuff, and it was flat lighting. At CBS, they use what I call, key lighting, more like the stages of New York, because that's the way television was in the early days. They used the lighting that the stage plays used in New York. But CBS was thinking the same way, where ABC was going to this flat lighting, which you get just about on everything today. All your sitcoms and all are all flat lighting. There's very few people use, which is kind of silly. Key lighting is, the reason why you use key lighting on a stage is because it's like a close-up. All the lighting goes on the main character on the side of a stage, and all the attention is on him or her, where on movies and television, you don't need the key light anymore. You just put the camera close-up. I'm getting very technical now.
No, it's interesting because some of these things you feel led to the end of the series, even though it was highly popular.
Well, I'm sorry, I lost you on that one.
Let's say some of these changes from CBS to ABC eventually led to the end of the series, I would imagine. These technical...
Yeah, we went 3 years. Mark really was an excellent salesman. And excuse me, he's much like Lawrence Welk and several. Excuse me, I should have brought my water in here. Several of the early television people, they produce their own shows and with their husband and wife and the whole family was on the shows. You may remember some of the Nelson family and on. Mark was, people would say, well, how did he sell that show to the sponsors? I says, he knocked on a door. And if somebody slammed a door in his face, he went to another one. He kept doing that. So Mark was an excellent salesman. He wasn't the world's greatest magician, but he was good, and he was lucky for us, because if we handed something to him and say, here, perform this, he would make an attempt to perform it and eventually do it, and which we were limited with time, and as you may know, that it was 15-minute segments. We found out that CBS was charging us. We got a check from Kellogg's, and we had to pay the bills, so we had to keep everything super tight. And that's the way it was. When if you went 5 minutes overtime, you had 10 minutes that you could use. So the director, Andy Sedaris, said, "Hey, we could shoot two more tricks and insert it in something." By this time, we were there several months, and CBS and everybody else had finally figured out how to do editing, not with the cutting the tape with and at a diagonal, because your sound, and I don't know if you know, on a tape, the sound is either precedes or, I can't remember what, either it's in front of or back of the picture. So that was a part of a second that you had to match it up. It was a bit of a trick. Nowadays, it's electronic, my Lord. I did a bunch of editing here for the Diamond Horseshoe Review, which is at Walt Disney World here, and I got hold of a Studio 9 editing for television, and on my set here at the house, I'm amazed what I could do. My Lord, it was just
frightening.
I said, my Lord, if CBS had had this back in 1960, they would have paid hundreds of millions of dollars for this program, where I paid like $110, something like that.
It It is definitely different. You know, Bev, what I think about when I think of the famous clowns in television, it's kind of interesting. On those early shows, like Howdy Doody and Captain Kangaroo, the clowns did not speak. But when Bozo was syndicated throughout the United States and became probably the world's most famous clown, Bozo talked, and in a lot of those markets, Bozo was the host of the show. What did you think, clowns not talking versus clowns talking?
I really don't know. I ended up talking on personal appearances because I made a little box from a cigar box, put a switch on it, hung it around my neck, and I called it my talking machine. So when I was on, I could talk, and when the switch was off, I couldn't talk. So that got me through those shows where I had to do some talking, where I did, you know, by myself, just personal appearances. And it became a good prop because when I was up around the crowd, the kids would reach up and turn me off. And then I'd start pantomiming again, and I'd look down and I'd flip the switch back on. I says, "Who turned me off?" "Don't turn me off." I says, "I can't talk if you don't turn me off." And sometimes the kids would say, "Rebo, how come you don't talk?" And I'd turn the machine on and I'd say, "Well, have you seen the TV set when it flutters?" Back in those days, the TV sets fluttered all the time. So you had to always be adjusting them. And I'd say, "My voice causes that." And they bought it. Kids are wonderful. No matter what you tell them, they believe it.
Absolutely. What did Rebo sound like? What voice did you come up with?
My regular voice. I tried it a couple of times with some strange voices. And in fact, when I was working with McDonald's to recreate Ronald McDonald, I tried different voices with him, and we gave up and said, "Oh, fooey, don't shut him up and let him just do pantomime." And so I got in with several of those things like that. I couldn't work with the Bozo thing. There was too many of them across the country, and it varied. They tried to keep him, you know, with the same similar voice, and I'm amazed at how well they did that too, because they use the guys, usually the guys doing the weather, weathermen or some minor part of the studio. They just say, "Hey, you're doing Bozo now," and they'd send in those packages to them, you know, to follow the games and the prizes and that kind of stuff.
It was interesting. You know, we are in the land now of reboot television, and so few people from that time in television, the 50s and the 60s, network television, are still with us, but you are still around, Mark is still around, Nani is still around. Have you ever thought about doing a reunion?
Well, I don't know. I think we're all three too old now to do it. I don't know what we would do. I did a live show about 2 years ago for a convention here of magicians, and I pantomimed Rebo putting the makeup on, telling stories as I did it. I've done this at colleges years ago, and it worked great at college. Colleges are ideal audiences in most cases. So I would always finish the show with that, putting makeup on, and then I'd go into this pantomime of Rebo with the music, and do some comical clown things, and at the end, more or less destroy myself and collapse on the stage. So I was using way back at when I first started doing it in the 60s. You know, da 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 da, and I had arrangements made on that, and then I had it recorded. Then when I heard "Send in the Clowns" on a Merv Griffin show one afternoon, I went, "Oh my Lord, I gotta have this!" And I was working at Disney at that time, and I had a television set up in my room. and I audio taped it real fast. The girl singing, sent in the clowns, and I called in our music leader at the Horseshoe there, and I said, "Can you get this thing orchestrated?" And he did, and I started using it, and that was a killer. And then I got a recorded version with a trumpet. And I can't remember who it was. It may have been Bobby Hackard back in those days. I'm not sure who it was that did that trumpet part. It's been so long since I played. But 2 years ago I used it, and it was a killer. It's on Facebook on my whatever they call it, my site. My daughter stuck it there. They taped it, and it plays pretty good for an old guy in his 80s doing that thing. I thought I'd slowed down, but I didn't. It wasn't that slow. It worked out okay.
Do you still like to work? If somebody called you and said, "We want you to do a show in Kentucky as Rebo," would you come?
Not as Rebo. I just don't want to put that makeup on again and take it off. It's just too much trouble, and it's just too demanding. But I still work shows. I worked one at the Veterans Hospital out here in Lake Nona. This is my fifth year of doing that for them. We started 2 or 3 years before they even opened. They had a portion of one building that was open, and it wasn't well known, but would go out there and entertain, and I did it again this year. And the guy that sets it up called me just 2 weeks ago and said, "Hey, I need you next year." So they got me booked again in December. I don't know if I'll make it, but it's really a pleasure to go out there and do that one for the veterans. They're in pieces out there. It's just sad. I made 3 trips over to the Vietnam area during that in the 1970-71, and that went from one end of Vietnam to the other, and also into Cambodia. Saw too much.
It's a tough time for the soldiers and everybody to talk about. What was it like over there?
Confusion. Here you thought that you had a group of people that was fighting to keep their independence, and they didn't seem like they didn't care. It didn't mean anything to them. I guess they've always been under oppression, so they figured, well, what difference does it make if the United States is in here? We consider them our rulers. If they're not here, whoever's in charge, we'll just follow them. It's a different thinking than what we have here. So it took me a while to get used to.
I can imagine. I was reading in your bio, Bev, that you developed the idea of making balloon animals.
Yeah, no, not balloon animals. The one with one balloon.
One balloon.
Yeah, you see, before that, they've used several balloons to make a dog or an animal or whatever character. That you a 15-inch one for the legs, a 340, I think it was, for the body and head and ears. They use the 15-inch one, so 315, which I don't think they even make those kind anymore. But I started with the 240, and now they're 260s. They added some more, you know, inches to it, 20 inches. But I'm the guy that started that and made it very popular. And I went around begging people to change. The guys are making balloon animals at fairs in those days and parties and things. And they told me I was nuts in the late 50s and early 60s. And then by the time the 70s came around, the clown clubs start popping up, and they started using them. But giving no credits to me, and no thank yous or anything like that. So, Mattel grabbed hold of a package I made. They asked me to put it out, one of the employees of Mattel who knew me, and said, make up a package for Mattel. And they came right up to the last minute. They were going to put it out, and then because of problems they had at that time, they backed out. That was about 1964 or 5, right in there.
Well, it's an interesting story, but you have worked with some of the great comedians of our time. I want you to I'm going to shoot some names at you. Tell me where you worked with them and tell me what they were like, and we'll start with Red Skelton.
He was a Joe. There's very few people, just a super, super nice guy. He didn't go around with an entourage. He went by himself. I ran into him right here at Kmart's. My wife was working at Kmart in Orlando, Florida here. He was at SeaWorld, and he came over to pick up some underwear. And the ladies called the house and said, Bev, get over here. Red's here. And I ran over, and I'm looking for him, and he runs into me with the cart. He was pushing a cart around. And I said, oh, Mr. Skelton. I never called him Red. He was Mr. Skelton. But, yeah, he was a super jewel. I mean, not many of them are like him, I tell you. And a true comedian. Oh, God. The stuff he came up with throughout his life and what he did with it was just unbelievable.
Tell me about Lucille Ball.
She was another super one. I never got friendly with her, but... I've got to respect. I'd be working with her on some clown gags, and she'd say, "What if I do this and twist this that way?" And I'd say, "Oh my God, much better." And sitting around, you know, you'd read the script on Monday morning, and she would sit there and correct it. The two writers they had and a director, and say, "We got to Jack, we got to get this changed. I want this changed here. There's no way I'm going to get over from this." From talking on the phone to the other side of the room without a line, I need something. I mean, she knew what she was doing, and a businesswoman like you wouldn't believe. I also worked on the Greatest Show on Earth TV version, which had Jack Palance in it. It wasn't too good of a show, but it wasn't real circus. You know how they do. When I'd supposed to be advising and helping with clown props, and... I'd say to their director, I said, you know, this isn't the way the circus would do it. He says, okay, we're taking poetic license. And I'm going, oh, God, I've heard that all my life in Hollywood. We'll do poetic license. And then, you know, they don't care. That's not the way the Indians fought the armies, or the army fought the Indian. They'd always say, oh, it's poetic license.
Tell me about Johnny Carson.
I didn't know Johnny too well. I turned down 2 times to be on his show. Mark Wilson appeared on there 2 or 3 times. They wanted me, I started doing a cigarette act when I was 14 years old, copying what other magicians had done at that point of time. You produce a lot of lit cigarettes and throw them to the floor and step on them and grab another one out of the air and all that stuff. Well, one of the things I did, which I stole from a guy by the name of Fraxen, Jose Fraxen, from Madrid, Spain, was to what is called tonguing a cigarette. It's, you pull it inside your mouth, and then you blow the smoke out. And I can do that too, all day long with that. I don't smoke, by the way, and I've been an anti-smoker all my life, but I did that act. They wanted me to not do the act, but just stand on the stage and pretend to be chewing the cigarette up and blowing the smoke out. And Johnny would be standing there and making derogatory comments about the nutty people in California and how they smoke cigarettes. And twice they called me in to do that with them, and twice I turned them down. So I said, let me do the act, and he can say whatever he wants. Now, Merv Griffin, I was booked to do 7 minutes of the act, which that's how long it was back then. And so we shot in the same studio where we shot Alakazam. And I knew the whole crew. And So I never did get to rehearse because of all the mess up with a little girl singer. I won't mention her name. She used to be with the Supremes, and she left. So you figure it out.
I think we'll,
It took her 2 hours of rehearsing. It was when she first broke away of two numbers. Oh, God. And I never got the chance. Excuse me. And they, the orchestra leader, handed my music to him. And I said, I got to talk to the drummer. He says, don't worry. You got everything written down here? It's all written. But I need to explain these things. He said, we'll get it. Don't worry. They played it perfect. And as I'm going out, the stage manager, we called him Mother Supreme. I don't know why. No, Mother Superior. I'm sorry. Mother Superior. Excuse me. Let me clear my throat.
Oh, no problem. We're chatting with Bev Bergeron, Rebo the Clown from the magical land of Alakazam. Coming up next hour, we're going to be joined by Rona Barrett, legendary gossip columnist, who's interviewed everybody from Lucille Ball to our current president. She interviewed him in 1980 and asked him about running for president. Oh, wait till you hear what he had to say and what Rona thought of him. I haven't talked to her yet about it. We'll find out together next hour. Bev, are you okay now?
Yeah, I'm okay.
Okay.
Almost.
Tell me
as
about...
I'm going, Mother Superior, stage manager, yelled and said, Ray Reeb! That's what they call me at CBS. And I said, and I motioned, yeah, you know, and he says, four. They cut me down to 4 minutes instead of seven. I've known not professional, guys who claim they were professional, that you'd say that too as they're getting ready to step on the stage to cut their act, to drop something. They would, I mean, two or three of them I've seen just say, well, I won't go on. And don't go on. And, well, I cut it 4 minutes and cut out, and it went very well. So unfortunately, I didn't have a tape recorder. Nobody had a tape recorder in those days. They only the studios and you know, big people, big companies. The home recorder wasn't available, so I didn't have I don't have a good copy of it. I have a kinescope, which I shot with an 8mm. That's, you know, you take it right off the television set, and you get a flutter because of the difference in the speed. 24 seconds, frames to a second, and 30 frames a second with television.
Bev, I want to run through these next three here. We got about 10 minutes left here. Bob Hope.
Okay.
Bob Hope.
Oh, I didn't know Bob that well. I worked a lot with him. He was not, for us, was not the friendly guy. And I was in rehearsals with him, and then we'd open, and then he'd follow us. But we didn't mix. We're like Andy Williams. We did 4 years opening for him at state fairs. And Andy and I'd be shooting pool at some places where we'd be at the hotel. They had a little bumper pool there thing, and he and I'd bump. And he was, you know, super nice guy. There are others like that. There was some I didn't care for.
Who didn't you care for? I know we don't like to talk about that, but who was just somebody who wasn't fun to work with? Maybe a nice person, but not fun to work with.
I didn't care for Humperdinck. He had to have two guys supposedly guarding him, and we had a suite next to each other in this little town in at the State Fair of Illinois, and I was going to my room, and all of a sudden, two guys grab me and throw me against the wall, and they were his bodyguards, supposedly. I said, whoa, 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 what are you guys doing? They said, well, you're not supposed to be around here. I said, that's my room right here. And they go, oh, you know, all this kind of stuff. By the way, they pulled that on a hotel employee. they got kicked out, and Humperdinck got kicked out of the room and all, and they couldn't stay in the motel. Holiday Inn.
Well, you got to be nice to those employees. You worked with the first host of The Tonight Show, Steve Allen. What was that like?
He was a genius. Pure genius. I mean, there's nothing he can't do. I love the fact that one time he put out a jazz album with a fake name and a fake picture and all that. And and fake reviews about how great he was. He was discovered in Indiana or wherever it was. And the jazz industry jumped all over it and said it was the greatest thing ever done and all. And he could do that. And I love it because I've That must be my phone, huh?
Yeah, but I think it was. But, you know, there's an interesting name here. Now, people might not remember this, but this person was involved in one of the most really traumatic television events in the history of television, certainly early television, that brought down one of the most beloved people in television, and that's Julius LaRosa. For those who don't remember, just Julius LaRosa was a singer on the Arthur Godfrey show. And one day... Tell the story, Bev.
Well, he came in and the press had gotten him and all that, and Godfrey had already fired somebody else and gotten great press. And from what I understand, LaRosa's manager said, "Hey, let's take advantage of this." And said, "Gee, LaRosa was fired." And Godfrey comes in the next day, and he had not fired LaRosa. And the press was all over Arthur Godfrey as, "Oh, you fired LaRosa?" And he says, "No, I hadn't." He said, "Well, that's what the report is, and we got it, blah, blah, blah." So he said, "Well, in that case, he's fired." Well, that's... he didn't want it that way. And he's kind of hurt real badly on that. When I worked with him, one of the things I was told not to do was to mention it. But after the shows, the people would come up, and of course they're all going, "Oh, about how's Arthur Godfrey? Have you talked to Godfrey lately?" And da-da-da on and stuff like that. And the poor man just did not want, you know, that discussion. But he and I got along real well. And I had a date on my last show. We did about 15 days of shows, something like that, or almost 3 weeks. And I had to leave as soon as I came off the stage. I opened, and he closed. So I was packed up, and I had to race to the airport to catch a plane to Dallas because I was opening the next night at another show. So he's singing. My bags are packed. I'm standing in the wings and I'm waving to the orchestra, you know, thanking them and saying goodbye, guys. He looks over the side and sees me. He turns to the audience and says, "Folks, just a minute. I want to say thank you to a guy who's been real good with me for the few weeks here." Walked over and thanked me and then walked back out. So I thought, gee, that's super nice, you know, when somebody does something like that.
Yeah, it's an interesting career he led. Disney, what was it like working at Disney?
I loved it, the Horseshoe Show. I never thought I'd get to do that show. I saw Wally Bogue in 58 out in California do it. And I said, "This is an ideal show. God, old-fashioned type thing, can-can girls and the orchestra in the pit and on and on and on. I mean, living a different world." If it wasn't for the backstage, not backstage, but in the offices of Disney, the politics, it's everywhere. It's a big company. You got to remember that. It's all politics in the back. But the Horseshoe was a jewel to work. Oh, I did better than 15 years with it. I started at Disneyland and to break me in, and then Wally Bogue put the show together and created. He and I came out together, California to Florida. He brought me out here, and then 3 years later, he left and said, "Okay, you're in charge now," and he left me to fight the politics of the company. And somebody was always wanting to close it down, change things into a ballet or whatever, and he warned me. So the thing was that he had power with Mrs. Disney, and every time we'd run into trouble, he'd say, "Let me call Mrs. Disney." He'd call her, he'd talk to her a little bit and tell her what was happening here. She says, "I'll take care of it." She'd call the studio and tell them to get that stuff all straightened out down here. And it got straightened out.
When you look,
I didn't have the power that he had. So when he retired, well, they retired. The whole show is closed. The building is nothing in it. It's sad sitting there with some. They're trying to serve a meal. No shows of any kind, and that's not right.
When you look back at your career, is there anything you regret?
Not really. I've thought about this over and over again. I've tried to quit show business about 1,000 times, and I keep getting offers. It makes no sense. Where other people say, "Gee, I've got to fight for this and fight for that," I've tried to get out of show business, and a phone would ring and say, "We got $1,000 for you if you do this," and I'm going, "Oh, $1,000," and I end up back in show business. And every time I turn around, that's the way it's been. Where I've got a degree in advertising, University of Texas, with marketing. And in fact, if they had allowed it, which they don't allow, you got secondary degrees. I could have had about 4 degrees, and I've got backing. I write a column for the Magic magazine. 15,000 circulation around the world, a monthly column on that. I write a weekly column for the local musicians here in this area. I feel sorry for the musicians. It's the jazz, you know all the jokes about the jazz musicians. There's no way they can work. Mm-hmm. But we're doing pretty good. This area here probably has more live music any given night to hear or see than even in New York or Las Vegas. Las Vegas really upsets me, because back in the 50s, when I'd go into Las Vegas, they had lounges. Every casino had a lounge show of musicians. Biggest names you could hear, Louis Prima and Kiwi Smith, for free. In fact, if they get to recognizing you at a place, they'll give you a drink.
That's right. Bev, when you look back at this career, how would you like to be remembered?
As a pioneer, I think. I pioneered so many things and opened up, and I guess because it got boring for me to keep doing it like the cruise ships. I worked cruise ships, and I said, "Oh, this is awful. I mean, you're stuck out in the middle of nowhere." So I'd go somewhere else, do something else, and I'd find something else. And I'd just like to be adventurous and keep doing things. I've been very successful. I don't know why. I mean, I don't know why some people just keep crying. They say, "Well, nobody calls me up and gives me anything." I said, "Well, you don't do that. You get the word out, you know. You go on your show. Go on Scott's show."
That's right. Come on the show, and we'll talk about it. Well, Bev, I got to tell you, this has been a pleasure, and there's so many things we didn't get a chance to talk about, like Willard the Wizard and your childhood.
Yeah.
So we're going to have you back on, and I hope we can make that happen real soon. But, Bev, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you for asking me, Scott. Hey,
Bev Bergeron, Rebo the Clown. You might remember him in the magical land of Alakazam, but a whole lot of other stuff he's done. Bev, take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Rona Barrett, coming up in about 10 minutes.
Men, help address a winter blood shortage so patients can continue to...